Good afternoon and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two arguments set for 1:30 and one for 3 o'clock. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Wade Birdwell, and to my left, Justice Dana Womack, and I am Lee Gabriel. So we will proceed with our first case, if the clerk will call the case.
The court will now call Kimberly Rick et al. Versus Michelin North America Incorporated, VF, Goodrich, in the pursuant to a common name. May it please the court, Mr. John Sanders will argue for the appellant. Mr. Chris Blackaby will argue for the appellee.
All right. Mr. Sanger, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. Let's court. We have a couple of issues to discuss, and I want to get some of them out of the way quickly so I can really focus on the Daubert issue and the 76A ceiling issue, because I think those are the two most complicated issues. But by focusing on the Daubert issue and the 76A ceiling issue, I don't want to downplay the seriousness of having opposing counsel refer to his opponent, lawyer, as dishonest as the day is long. That is an improper argument where the court recognized on the record that an instruction would only exacerbate the harm.
Well, wasn't that because the jury had already been sent back to deliberate?
You didn't
actually raise the issue of improper jury argument until the jury had been charged, argument had occurred, and the case had actually been submitted to the jury and they had begun deliberations.
Yes, Your Honor.
So to bring them back out from deliberations would have actually just highlighted everything, and that's what the trial court was actually talking about, don't you think?
I think what he was saying, that giving an instruction on dishonesty of counsel, you should ignore that, would not be helpful.
Is that our standard, though? Aren't we supposed to be looking at it in terms of whether or not it could have been curable at the time that it occurred if the judge had been properly informed of it? Obviously, you don't have to object to it if it's incurable on its face, but we're still looking at it from the standpoint of the time that it occurred, correct?
Yeah, I certainly agree. If it was curable on its face, then an objection needed to be made at the time. If it was incurable, then an objection could be launched as soon as possible after the jury left, which is exactly when I launched the objection. And the judge did say, yeah, instructing the jury, this would raise a red flag. Record 16, page 136, 137. But as I was saying, I think that this court's opinion in American Petroleum versus PPG, reported at 679 Southwest 2nd, 740, as well as Rule 269, addressed this issue as thoroughly as I could. I would probably move on to the more complicated points. Another point I don't want to give a short shrift to, but I think it's less complicated, is the fact that we have a zero damage award for everything but funeral expenses in a double fatality crash where it's agreed that my clients were 0% at fault for that crash. No award to the Santa Stevens. Her husband, who's been left a widower, gave testimony. Her children gave testimony. No award, zero award. Kimberly Witt lingered in the hospital with documented pain for hours and hours, yet no award. I think it's evidence of the bias that the jury had. But this is so thoroughly addressed by this court's opinion in Hammett versus Zimmerman, reported at 804 Southwest 2nd, 663, that I really can't add to that point. And then finally, as a point I want to address briefly without downplaying, is the gross negligence. The court granted a directed verdict on gross negligence, which of course changed the scope of my ability to examine Michelin's witnesses called in their case. So it changed the scope of the evidence from that point forward. So it was a very significant thing. And there was clear evidence of gross negligence. For example, there is a design here that was made contrary to the marketing for the tire. And the difference in the design as made and as marketed was a design feature calculated to stop or minimize the risk of tread separations, the exact failure mode we have. So, I mean, and there is objective knowledge that tread separations are a very serious risk of damage, of danger. We have it both through governmental publications and through Michelin's own failure modes and effects analysis, where a company that makes an original equipment product, like this was an original equipment product for Ford, has to go through and analyze the risk from all different types of failure modes and rank their danger. The rank for a tread separation failure is ranked, nothing is ranked higher in terms of its danger. So we have a subjective and an objective risk, and the court nevertheless granted a directed verdict on that, which changed the scope of the case from that point forward in terms of its evidence, in terms of its argument, and in terms of the issues submitted to the jury. But again, there's not more I can say about that than what is in the appellate brief. I want to focus now to the Dalbert challenge, because truth be told, there is not a ton of tire experts on either side that are available to speak. And as you can imagine, those experts which have gotten their experience in the industry from Michelin have non-compete agreements which foreclose them from testifying in cases against Michelin. So the expert who is the tire expert who testified in this case is somebody that Michelin has tried to get their tire, their testimony stricken several dozen times and has failed every time until this case. In this case, they were able to get the judge to prejudge Mr. Carver's conclusions, not his methodology. And that is where the mistake was made. As this court...
How is the trial judge supposed to ignore the Supreme Court's decision concerning Mr. Rogan's identical methodology concerning liner marks? How was the trial court to ignore that? How was it distinguished in this particular case from what was held in Mendez?
Well, here's what was held in Mendez. What was held in Mendez, and I'm going to quote, because it's important. What Michelin is trying to do is conflate these two cases, which are very not conflatable, and let me explain why. Cooper Tire versus Mendez published that, I think it's 204 Southwest 3rd, 797. At page 802 and 803 is where the court discusses Mr. Grogan's analysis. And here's what they say. Grogan's theory of wax contamination was unreliable and should not have been admitted. His opinion of wax contamination. There's no opinion of wax contamination in this case. The court goes on to say, again, page 802, 803, that there was, quote, no proof that, quote, wax contamination is a cause of belt or tread separation, or that liner powder marks and polishing are proof of such a theory. So they said, you can't talk about wax contamination, and you haven't showed any evidence that liner pattern marks are proof of wax contamination. Wax contamination is not an issue in this case. And to the extent that they said, look, you don't have any proof that liner pattern marks are evidence of wax contamination, I haven't seen literature that said that liner pattern marks are evidence of wax contamination either. But that is not Mr. Carl's opinion, and it was not the issue we were raising.
It wasn't in Mendez, and in this case. In both instances, the expert who is being challenged is using the presence and the visibility of liner marks, okay, sort of as a fingerprint. And it's a fingerprint because the curing and the adhesion didn't occur the way it was supposed to, and that if it had occurred the way it was supposed to, effectively the fingerprint would have been obliterated. So in other words, it's not a defect in and of itself. It is evidence of a defect because it is evidence that adhesion in the curing process did not occur the way it was supposed to, therefore inferring a manufacturing defect in that regard.
In that regard, here's what I would say the difference is. The difference is Mr. Grogan was trying to say, and first of all, I will agree that both Mr. Cottles and Mr. Grogan mentioned liner pattern marks. Mr. Grogan said it is evidence of wax contamination. Mr. Cottles didn't say that. And here's another.
But the Supreme Court of Mendez said it's not evidence of defect. Now, that was a defect, a different type of theory of defect. Okay, let's concede that. But it's still, the court's holding, there's no evidence, there's no literature to say that, in fact, this is a fingerprint that establishes defect of any kind.
First, I would like to say this. What the Supreme Court said is that the underlying proof of the wax contamination, in fact, I want to quote, Grogan, quote, postulated that the inner surfaces of the tire had been contaminated with wax, but the foundational proof was lacking. The foundational proof is there's no proof of wax contamination, not that there's no proof that liner pattern marks aren't evidence of something. And
so you're saying the Supreme Court didn't say that by looking at liner pattern marks is not the proper methodology of deciding whether a manufacturing defect occurred?
I think what they said was this, is there's no proof of wax contamination in your case.
I can understand that, but answer my question if you would. Didn't they say that looking at liner pattern marks is not a proper methodology of determining whether a manufacturing defect occurs? Whatever the cause for the liner pattern marks might be, whether it's wax contamination or water contamination, that's not a proper methodology. Isn't that what they said?
No, they didn't. They never said that. What they said was, this is where they talk about liner pattern marks, that liner pattern marks, and there's nothing, no published literature said that liner pattern marks and polishing are proof of wax contamination. That's what they said. But I would go on to say this, Your Honor. What I would say is that Mr. Grogan had only his publication. What Mr. Cottles had was A, to show it's not Ipsy Dixit, that my training at Goodyear Dunlop was that liner pattern marks are evidence of contamination. He offered sworn testimony from Thomas Johnson, also trained at Goodyear Dunlop in the same methodologies. He also offered Thomas Giapponi's published literature, which was not a thing that Mr. Grogan had. He also offered
that the literature that he said he didn't know anything about the author and didn't know the accuracy of the findings in that literature?
No, that was a third publication. The third publication was an International Journal of Mechanical Engineering. The article in that says, hey, you're supposed to cure out these lawn pattern marks in the course of curing a tire properly. That was one publication. Thomas Giapponi's publication was a totally separate third publication, which also talked about lawn pattern marks as needing investigation for tire
failure. Was there any literature whatsoever that indicated that the forming of the liner pattern marks in any way, shape, or form impaired the adhesion process?
Yes, Mr. Giapponi's literature.
Okay.
Which is quoted in the brief at, there's an extensive quote on page 39 from that part of his paper, which was entered into evidence as Exhibit 61, I believe.
Okay, so the evidence is fairly clear that these tires, before they're properly before they're cured, are covered by liners.
That's true.
And it's fairly common for the liners to leave a mark on the uncured tire.
That's true.
Okay. They always have marks. So how is it possible for those tire for the marks to in fact impair tire curing adhesion? It would seem to me that if they always impair curing adhesion, they would impair it as to every tire, since every one of them has a liner and they all leave marks.
During the curing process, what happens is, and I'll read from you, I'll read to you from the literature. Liner pattern marks from the fabric liner used during storage should be totally obliterated in a properly cured tire. One should never see liner pattern marks on a tire that has been properly cured. Because it's like if you have a grilled cheese sandwich with maybe a slice of white Swiss and a slice of yellow cheddar, and you grill that sandwich together, if you pull apart and it pulls apart where only white cheese is on this slice of bread and only yellow cheese on this slice of bread, you didn't really grill it right. You didn't get the cheeses to come together. And so when you pull apart a tire and you can still see a fabric pattern that was there before the tire was cured, it means you didn't cure it right. That's what Thomas Giapponi's book says. You should investigate this. And that's what the International Journal says, the International Mechanical Engineering Journal says. That's what Marvin Bozas, Watch the Diamonds article says. If you see this in a retreaded tire, you got to scrap that tire. Don't retread it.
Okay, Mr. Sanger, your time has expired.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
If you give Mr. Blackerby 2 additional minutes, please. 2.
Thank you, May it please the court. I'm going to start off where he left so I don't forget, but we're talking about the literature on liner pattern marks, and since you were asking about that, Mr. Cottle's, contrary to what Mr. Sanger said, did not offer this article, this book, Mr. Giapponi's book, in support of his opinions on liner pattern marks, and the reason why I didn't do it is because it doesn't support him. Mr. Sanger is saying it supports his opinion, but in Mr. Cottle's 60-page affidavit and his deposition, in which I asked him, give me all scientific peer-reviewed publications that support that theory, he did not identify it. And the reason why Mr. Giapponi's book does not support it, he mentions liner pattern marks, but he also says that liner pattern marks are common to see in failed tires. They don't equal defects. And most importantly, and this is probably why Mr. Cottles didn't want to cite it, he says that if you have a problem with adhesion in a tire, that tire is going to fail early in its life. And in this case, we had a tire that was 5.5 years old, had 81,000 miles on it. So Mr. Giapponi's book was very contrary to Mr. Cottle's, all of his theories, not just his liner pattern mark theory. And I will note that the quote that Mr. Sanger just read to you about liner pattern marks, that one did come from the energy analysis paper that we talked about. That's the paper that Mr. Cottle's downloaded from the internet from some place in India, which he didn't know anything about the authors, didn't know their qualifications, didn't know anything about what the basis of that was, and basically at the end of the question says, well, I'm not relying upon it. It just says what I think, but didn't have any idea what the credibility of it was and if there was any testing on it. So I wanted to touch that before I got into my argument. I'll start off with the Mr. Caudill's partial exclusion, and because I think that's the central focus of this case. In order to get some kind of reversal on that issue, they have to show that it was an abuse of discretion, obviously, by the trial judge. And they also have to show that it was harmful error, you know, under the Appellate Rule 44A1, and that means that it probably caused an improper judgment. I'll start on that second part first, because it's kind of the easiest one. They didn't address it. They didn't talk about it in their brief. They didn't raise it for some reason. I have no idea why. But we cited a case that basically says if you don't address the harmful error analysis, you know, sorry, you waived it. And so I don't have anything to respond to why he thinks it's harmful error because he didn't raise it. And so I think that's an easy way to dispose of this because it was waived, and we cited the NRA GP case in our brief. In that case, the court said, well, you raised harmful error, but you just alleged it. You didn't actually show harmful error. In this case, they just completely ignored it together. But going on to whether or not it was an abuse of discretion by the judge to exclude it, we talked about liner patterns remarks, but there was two theories. Remember, he had five defect theories in this case, and two of them were excluded. He was allowed to testify in the other three. One of them was the liner pattern marks, and one of them was these belt issues. There were four that Mr. Collins would admit to. There were four peer-reviewed scientific publications in journals that said the existence of liner pattern marks are not evidence of a defect. I ask him, you recognize this? Yes. Where are your scientific peer-reviewed publications that say liner pattern marks are a defect? You've got these out there. Where is yours? And basically, he came up with this energy analysis paper out of India. He had no other scientific peer-reviewed publication. He didn't even mention Mr. Grogan is the other thing they mentioned, his book, of course.
Was there any evidence that during his experience in his professional experience, he had conducted any type of testing, any type of post-tread separation analysis of tires, that every time he looked at a tread separation, there were line pattern marks of visible, that in no instance did, when he looked at a tire separation, tire that did he see anything but tire pattern marks, line pattern marks?
No, there's nothing like that. I mean, the fact of the matter is when you
see... So that's why you're saying this is ipsa dixit.
Absolutely. Okay. He said, yeah, just trust me. I was trained on this. But he says the industry trained him on it, but you look at the industry literature, it all, without exception, says liner pattern marks do not equal defect. And as you've pointed out, Justin, well, his basic theory is anytime you see liner pattern marks, that means there was this improper adhesion, therefore there must be a defect, whether it be from wax contamination or, in this case, alleged water contamination or old materials. But the fingerprint that you see, once you see liner pattern marks, that means, gosh, you have a defect, and therefore... that's the problem. That's what caused it.
Okay,
he's got no support.
I'm going to get you off of this because there's something more that troubles me about this case. Okay, looking at the medical from Ms. Kitt, she's got a closed fracture of her femur, closed fracture of her forearm, two cervical vertebrae fractures, four ribs fractured, all kinds of basically serious traumatic injuries when she goes to the hospital after this accident. And the jury found she suffered no pain and suffering in this case. Why are we not to pay any attention to the fact that the jury basically just decided we're going to give you a little bit for your funeral expenses, but otherwise we're going to ignore serious traumatic injuries with regard to our other findings? How are we to compartmentalize what appears to be clear, you know, disregard for the evidence with regard to one part of the verdict and then say, oh, because they were going to say there wasn't any evidence, any problems with regard to their consideration of the evidence with regard to Michelin's liability?
Well, I will say one thing. The plaintiffs didn't raise the insufficiency of the evidence on as to the liability factors. They said basically if you reverse, You need to also reverse on damages.
They actually did in their motion for new trial, but you're right. They don't put it here in their brief.
Right. They didn't. And that's not.
I'm still back to this issue of how are we to ignore what appears to be a clearly defective verdict and therefore a clearly defective jury with regard to damages and then say, but it's okay with regard to their liability finding.
Well, I think you have to look at, assess the evidence that was placed, and if there was sufficient evidence to support the judgment in this particular case, then it should stand. Regardless of the damages, that's another issue. But in terms of the judgment on liability, which is what we're about, what you'd have to find is that they made the wrong decision on liability because the evidence is so overwhelming on liability that you should throw the baby out with the bathwater. Because they found they made the wrong decision on damages, they must have made the wrong decision on liability, even though you have all this testimony, I think, that supports their finding on that issue. And again, plaintiffs didn't raise that. They didn't raise
it. Your basic argument is because at some point in time there was an issue about her being a Jehovah's Witness and refusing a transfusion, but whether she's transfused or not has absolutely nothing to do with whether she's feeling pain for 4 broken ribs, okay?
I agree with that. Yeah, sure.
So that's really what I'm having trouble with. And the citation you give me is actually a miscitation. Your style is Beavers, but your citation is actually to Adams versus Donahue out of Amarillo. Okay? And I'm familiar with the case that cited that because I cited it in my dissent in the Blevins case, which is a Supreme Court case called, just to make sure everybody's on board with the same thing. Southern Pine Lumber versus Andrade, but in that particular case, the Supreme Court said, well, it's immaterial about the zero damages finding because they found that the plaintiff was contributory negligent and there was plenty of evidence to support the contributory negligence finding. And then that's just cited without any discussion by the Amarillo Court of Appeals in the case that you cite to me.
Okay.
So here I've got a woman who's not contributorily negligent, absolutely no reason for her being injured. I've got catastrophic injuries to her, and I've got a jury finding that basically says, oh, no, there's no pain. So I'm seeing factual distinctions between this and Southern Pine, maybe. Any way to address that?
Well, the way I would think, they made a distinction because the contributory negligence, that's on their liability. They found evidence that she was contributory negligent, and somehow, even though they disregarded the damages evidence, that was okay. I would say the same applies here. There's plenty of evidence that the tire was not defective, even if it wasn't her being contributorily negligent. There's plenty of evidence as to at least Michelin that the tire was not defective. We have expert testimony and whatnot, and I would suggest to you that the plaintiffs don't have any competent expert testimony to support their theories. And because they found that, then you should not disturb the finding on liability. It's looking at the record as a whole, it has all that has plenty of support. And so I don't know that one transgresses to the other. I will say this, there was some testimony, and you're right. I don't know why the jury decided the way they did. There's nothing in the record that says why they made that determination. It is the province of the jury to do that. And we suggested, maybe because she refused treatment. I don't know. I agree with you that we were surprised. But there's nothing about, they did find liability as to another party in the case. And so I don't know that means they're not going to find liability. They were so prejudiced against the plaintiffs that they couldn't have found liability. They did find liability. They found that the owner of the truck was liable. And so I think that there's nothing to challenge or to call into question their finding on the liability cases, at least as to Michelin. And this case doesn't get reversed unless there's no support for the finding as to Michelin on liability. And so that's the best I can give you, Your Honor. I was going back to the other defect theory, again, that was excluded. Because, again, this is a partial exclusion. You got to prove that, if you hadn't excluded this evidence, there would have been some other result. The second theory that we didn't talk about, which is the belt placement issues. And again, I think that not only do they not have, and again, any peer-reviewed scientific publication to support it, you've got scientific peer-reviewed publications that go against it. I asked Mr. Cottles, you recognize those are out there? Yes. Do you have anything to support it? No.
Now, there's plenty of case law that says that you can be in spec and still be defective, correct?
There's case law that says you can be...
So the fact that the anomalies that they're citing to or that were excluded all were within spec doesn't conclude the analysis.
Well, here's two things. Number one, you do have to prove that it's outside specification or outside planned output. That's what you have to prove. That's part of what the question the jury was asked. And Mr. Cottles was asked, is these outside specifications, are these... There's no evidence at all because we have specifications on these very issues. The Michelin has a specification to say how much of a dog ear you can have. It has specifications on offsets. They have specifications that... And so there are specifications that govern it. If they're outside those specifications, and it renders it unreasonably dangerous because of that, then you might have a defect. The literature that I'm talking about. So we have the one thing. They can't prove, and Mr. Cottles could not prove, that they are outside specifications. In addition to that, though, he also has to prove that renders it unreasonably dangerous. And that goes to the literature I discussed. The literature in this says these belt issues that you talk about don't matter a hill of beans. You recognize that's out there. Yes, I do. Where is your literature that says, yeah, these kind of belting issues and, you know, kind of whatever he has means that the tire was unreasonably dangerous and that it was a defect that could cause the tire to fail? I don't have any. And so that's where we're left. So not only does he fail his burden on showing that it's outside spec, but he also fails to show that renders it unreasonably dangerous. And so what you have is Mr. Cottles saying these two things, these liner pattern marks, these belting issues that I observe, and then he jumps. It's the classic analytical gap. Because I observed those things, that means that this tire is defective, and that's the reason why it failed. And I don't have any support for it other than I'm saying it is. I don't have any support for it except for paper in India on liner pattern marks, you know, that I don't know anything about. But you need to trust me because, you know, I know it. And that's just not. That's the kind of thing that in Mendez the court said was not enough, and you got to give us more. And so that's why we think it was properly excluded. I will say this. You know, we have these, as to those theories, we have these Robinson factors. I get that you don't have to prove them all. It's up to the trial judge to say whether or not they should apply or not apply. And this is standard is abuse of discretion standard. They didn't address those factors in Daubert and Mendez. The Supreme Court went through all of them and said, yeah, they don't meet the Daubert. I suggest to you that the trial court could have done the same thing here. And that's probably how he'd made his decision, is that none of these factors did they even address at the trial court level, nor did they address on their appellate brief. And so I think that it's almost impossible. I can't imagine abuse of discretion based upon this record. And I will note one of the things counsel started for was the idea that Mr. Cottles has been allowed to testify in all these cases without being excluded. I will tell you those are trial court opinions. I don't know what was in the record for those trial court opinions. Obviously, those trial court opinions weren't binding on the trial judge. They're not binding upon you. I don't know what the record is. What we have to do is look at the record in this case. And I also give to you that, and I point out in my brief, Mr. Carlson, when he was excluded to Mendez, had testified a lot, many, many times. That the fact that he had been testified, had been challenged, but had been allowed to testify is not dispositive of the issue. What we have to do is look at the record in this case. Before I forget, I guess I should go back and look at the other two issues because I see I only have a couple of minutes left.
You probably need to just pick one.
I guess you're probably right. I think on the gross negligence, they didn't find liability. I don't think directed verdicts shouldn't. The fact that they didn't find liability on design defect, you can't have gross negligence without design defect. Now, picking my one, I'll talk about the improper jury argument. You have to prove there was error, not invited, they preserved it, it's not curable, and you also have to prove that it's reversible. This is from the Stanford Fire versus Reese case.
What is your contention that it was provoked?
Well, I think the contention is Mr. Sanger made an argument about a component called GSK and basically said this tire is less robust than this tire because that a tire made at another plant, because this one had GSK, which is a small sliver of rubber under the tread, and our tire didn't because it was made at this other plant. And that was the argument he made in closing argument. There was no expert testimony that said that at all. In fact, the only testimony in the record was that they were similar, if not our tire from one plant performed slightly better. And so that was the idea. He threw out something with that his expert hadn't even posited. He just threw it out to try to confuse the jury. And so that's the reason why I think it was responded. And again, they have to show that it was it caused some kind of improper verdict. And if you look at the cases on this, it's people calling people Nazis and revealing that the trial attorney was a felon and had been, that's the kind of thing you have to do, not one word, not about Mr. Sanger, but it was about his argument. He said the argument was dishonest. It wasn't calling Mr. Sanger dishonest.
Your time's expired,
thank
sir.
You.
Thank you. Mr. Sanger?
Mr. Blackerby keeps saying that Mr. Collins only had the Indian mechanical engineering paper at his deposition to talk about Ron Appellant marks. The double record isn't set at the deposition. He had, and at his deposition, he had testimony from a Cooper tire failure analyst, from another Goodyear Dunlop tire failure analyst, and he had this one paper. When he came to the Dalbert hearing, that's when he had the other additional papers. Also, when Michelin offered Mr. Giapponi's paper, that's when we pointed out to the judge that Mr. Giapponi says there are times when imprints, he's talking about line and pattern marks, should be investigated as a possible cause or contributor of tire failure. Some of these events include when you have a poorly laid up components, which we showed, and evidence of foreign materials, which we showed. So that was their literature that said you should investigate line and pattern marks as a cause of tread separation. That's on page 39 of the brief, citing to the record at CR, close record, 2324 through 25. That's where that's in the record. I also want to note that the Supreme Court earlier this year, in the Wendring versus Kerr case, said literature is not necessary to support an expert opinion, although it tends to strengthen the basis for the opinion and is therefore preferred. So one, you don't need literature necessarily. Two, we did in fact have literature. We had four different articles. Now they complain about some of the articles, but one of the articles is an article they introduced into evidence, which said you should investigate it under these circumstances. I want to talk swiftly about the issue that you raised, Justice Birdwell. What this court said in Hammett versus Zimmerman was that no jury has the authority, quote, to completely ignore the undisputed facts of the case. And when the court, when the jury awards nothing for nominal damages, quote, and there is uncontroverted evidence of an objective injury. So there's no authority for the jury to ignore that evidence. And the Texas Supreme Court, in the Golden Eagle Archery case, reported at 116 Southwest 3rd, 757, said, when only one category of damage is challenged on the basis that an award in that category is zero or too low, a court should consider whether the evidence unique to that category is so against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence as to be manifestly unjust, shock to conscience, or clearly demonstrate bias in the jury. I think in this case, the no damage verdict clearly demonstrated bias in the jury under the Texas Supreme Court's Golden Eagle Archery case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for your arguments and for your briefs. They've been very helpful, and your case is submitted.